You're listening to Cindy's Voice, a podcast that aims to raise awareness and advocate for the enslaved in an effort to end sex trafficking and sexual exploitation. Together, we're a community that educates, equips, and empowers you to take action against modern-day slavery. Every episode, we bring you inspirational stories of survivors who have been through the ordeal of human trafficking and sexual assault. In addition, we interview key advocates in the anti-trafficking movement and have them share their comments on the detrimental effects of human trafficking in our society. Now, here is your host, Cindy.
Hi, welcome to Cindy's Voice. I am Cindy Rivero, your host, and my guest today is Katharina McLeod, a survivor of sexual exploitation for over 15 years. She's also executive director of Rising Angels, a nonprofit that helps women who are leaving the sex trade by providing them with supportive services and safe environments. She is also a public speaker, educator, and advocate, and has been bringing awareness to these worldwide problems since 2010. One of the most courageous people you'll ever meet. I don't want to keep you from personally meeting her, so here is Katharina. Hi, Katharina. Welcome to Cindy's Voice podcast. How are you today?
Good. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to do this and to bring some awareness around what's going on.
Great to hear that. And Katharina, tell us a little bit about yourself. What do you do for fun? And what is your favorite color? And do you have any hobbies? Are you a cat or a dog person?
What about you? Okay. My favorite color is pink. I'm a girly girl. I really am. You know, it's funny because I'm covered in tattoos, right? So everybody's like, oh, she's this tough girl. No, I'm a girly girl. I really am.
Don't judge.
I love 80s and 90s music. So I like to go dancing, to 80s and 90s music. I read, I'm a big animal lover. So I have, you know, two cats, one dog. I just love animals. So I'm always at the person who's at like the, you know, petting zoos or, you know, places you can interact with animals. I find that to be my sanctuary. So, I mean, hobbies, I don't know if I have really any hobbies. I'm a mom of four. So between work and my kids and, you know, social life, I'm pretty busy. But when I get to my downtime, I really just like to read and just, you know, I love nonfiction. So I read a lot of autobiographies and I read a lot about people's stories because I find that it just inspires me to keep going because there's days that things are hard and tough, right? I just do whatever I feel comes naturally. I like to be outside. I like, you know, just to sit with nature. That's my thing.
So, Katharina, it's my understanding that you are a survivor of sexual assault, right?
Yes.
And I would like you to share your story as much as you feel comfortable with, so we can understand what happened, and then we will talk regarding what's going on nowadays regarding sexual assault and, you know, some points that we prepare, okay?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do this for a living. I do share my story, but we could be here for a very long time, so I'm going to try to, you know, put it down a little bit. So, you know, for me, starting as a little girl, so probably my earliest memory of being raped was 2 years old. And that was by a family member. And that went on for many, many years. And along the way, two other men would start raping me. So there was something that happened in my brain where I believed that this was what my purpose in life was to just be abused and used by men, especially from my family member abusing me. You know, they're supposed to take care of you and love you and teach you things. And instead they were using me sexually. They would sit me down to watch pornography. So I was exposed to pornography very young. And then I would be, you know, forced to do the acts that were happening on what was happening in that scene with the pornography. And so it just, you know, I was a happy little girl who went to church and, I believed in God. My family was very big in it, but this started happening to me, and I remember the shift. I was probably around 5 years old, and I just felt angry, and I felt trapped, and I didn't know who to trust or who to talk to, or even if I could say anything, because there were threats, like, we'll hurt you, we'll hurt your little brother. And I believed them. So fast forward to my teenage years, I kind of went crazy. 12. So my parents had divorced. I had that daddy hole in my heart. The sexual abuse had happened, and I knew how to sexually please a man, and I used that to get attention. I used my sexuality to feel loved, to feel wanted. I started drinking at 12 and doing drugs at 12, and I was just broken. I was broken, and I never got help for anything, so I didn't know even how to do life. My mother was, I think when her and my father divorced, she became depressed and went into her own little world, and we were kind of left to fend for ourselves. So I was an angry, rebellious teenager.
And did you stay with your mom, or did you move with your dad?
Stayed with my mom, and it was my mom and I have two brothers, and we were so poor. We were poor. We lived in the welfare system. We didn't have food every day. We were struggling all the time. We were hungry. And I hated my life. I became a cutter. I became very suicidal. And at 14 years old, I got pregnant. And in my mind, I thought, wow, if I have this baby, this baby will never hurt me. It'll never leave me. All these things that I was struggling with, I thought that this child could fulfill. So I had my daughter, who I wasn't prepared to be a mom. I didn't have any of the skills to be a mother. My own mother didn't teach me a lot of things. I was still a child. I was 15 when I had her. I just turned 15 years old. And here I was with this baby, and I'm like, what am I going to do with this? And she got in the way of my crazy life, of my partying, of my boyfriends. And all of my boyfriends were abusive. From the time I was 12 years old, men were hitting me. And that was normal, from being abused as a child to starting to date men, they were abusive. They would hit me, they would sexually abuse me, but that was normal. That was my normal. So I gave my daughter to my mother and just continued on my crazy rampage in life. And dating guys and bringing guys home. And, my child was witnessing the abuse. I didn't love myself. I didn't know what love was. And I just accepted that that was my fate. So at 17 years old, I met a man who was very abusive. And I liked him more than the rest. And I ended up marrying him. And I knew it was wrong, but at the same time, I felt like all men were abusive, so I might as well be with somebody that I like, right?
At that point, it's pretty much like you were choosing which one to abuse you, right?
Right. That's how I felt, right? So he was in and out of jail constantly. The violence was horrible. He was very mentally and physically abusive. Like, I would put something somewhere, and he would move it. I would hang a picture on the wall and he would move that picture, and I'd be like, no, I hung it here. And he'd be like, no, you didn't. So there was a lot of mental abuse going on, and I felt crazy. But every time he went to prison, whoever was his friend at the time would have to keep an eye on me. So bring me for jail visits, bring me for groceries, make sure I was being a good wife. And my husband and I had a child together. So I had two children at this point. And the last time he went to jail, it was crazy. He would do things like, I would be sleeping and him and I would be separated, and he would break in my house. He would beat me, he would rape me, he would put guns at my head. And I kept leaving him and going back and leaving him and going back. And so the last time he went to prison, his friend was supposed to keep an eye on me, make sure I was being this good wife. I was almost 19.
Okay.
I was almost 19. I had been with my husband for about 2 years, and he was back in jail, and they had moved him to a halfway house. And, I had made it very clear that I didn't want to be in our marriage anymore because of the abuse and the drug abuse, that he was an addict. And, you know, I told him, like, I couldn't continue like this. You know, he was violent to our daughter. And he, you know, cried and said, oh, I'll change. And so I said, okay, if you can change and prove it, I'll come back, but not until that point.
So the love was there, but yes. I do not want the abuse. You tried to establish healthy boundaries to an abuser, which usually does not work.
No, right? And, you know, I think the fact that, you know, the last time he went to jail and you're removed from somebody physically abusing you all the time, it changes something in you, right? Like, you start to realize, like, this isn't what it's supposed to be like. You know, he would call me and swear at me and threaten me, but it was different. He wasn't hitting me because he was removed, because he was in prison. So this friend who, you know, we started hanging around. It was my husband's friend. He was taking me, like I said, for jail visits, for groceries. He was a nice person. And, you know, I remember one day I had dropped my kids by my mom's house, and I went to pick them up and they weren't there. This guy had taken them for ice cream. And I was like, wow, that's weird. You know, like somebody who's kind of normal. It was just very weird. So I ended up, it was a lot of stress. And so I'm going to call this guy, my husband's friend, let's call him Chris. Okay. So Chris was going away for a weekend with his family to Niagara Falls. So he asked me if I wanted to go. You know, do you want to just get a break from all this chaos? And we were friends, and I thought, okay, this will be good. I'll go. My mom will watch the kids. I'm going to get a break. And we left on a Friday. And on the Saturday, I called home. Now this is going back 25 years. Okay. So I called home. There was payphones, only a payphone. I called home to, you know, check on my kids. My mother was hysterical. My husband had been there on a day pass and taken our daughter and refused to give her back, and police were involved. But I couldn't come home. You know, I didn't drive, you know, his family drove. So she assured me, you know, everything's kind of okay. And we got back into the city on a Monday morning, and we went back to Chris's house to get his car. And I called my mom and I was like, Mom, you know, I'm back in town. I'm going to come home. Again, she's freaking out. My husband's at the door. He's threatening to kill her. He's threatening to kill the kids. So I called the police. I said, listen, this guy's in a halfway house. He's violating all his conditions. Put him back in jail. So Chris drove me home, well, drove me to my mother's house. And when we pulled up, the police were there with my husband, but I didn't get out of the car because I didn't want conflict. And they let my husband go, which they never should have. I don't know. He was in a, he had conditions. In a halfway house, you're supposed to be out looking for work. You're not supposed to be threatening and harassing people. Well, the police let him go. And I went, after he left, I went into my mother's house and Chris went on his way. And the next morning, I stayed by my mom because I was scared, because I'm, you know, as the day progressed, you know, the halfway house is calling me. My husband hasn't returned. My husband's mother's calling me. So I'm thinking he's waiting for me to leave because he's going to hurt me. You know, that's always, if I can't have you, nobody will. It was always like this, always just violent, right? So I was scared to leave the house. So I stayed at my mom's. And the next morning, around 8:30 in the morning, Chris knocked on my mother's door. And he came into where I was sleeping and he's like, hey, are you okay? And I'm telling him, you know, my husband's like out there, he's at large, I'm scared, you know? And he's like, okay, just come with me, I've got something to do. And I'm like, okay. So we went for this long drive and I'm noticing we're driving and we're heading up north. And I remember looking at him after I seen the sign to bury, and I said, well, where are we going? And he turned around and told me he had killed my husband. And he was taking me with him to bury his body. So I, you know, the fear, the confusion, all of that's going through my head. I'm like, oh my God, if I overreact, he's going to kill me. I'm not coming home. And I won't get into details about it, but he did kill my husband. He did take me with him and he did bury him in front of me. And then he held me and my kids hostage for about 3 years. And that's what led me into prostitution. So in order to deter the police, he wanted me to join a woman's support group for abused women. And I did this. And I was allowed to talk about the abuse from my husband. Obviously couldn't say that he was dead. Couldn't say that, you know, Chris was abusive, because Chris was very abusive. He would burn me with cigarettes. He would whip me. He'd play Russian roulette with me all the time. So I joined this abuse group, and you become friends with these women. You know, you're sharing some of your intimate details about, you know, horrific stuff that's happened. And there was one woman in there who, she was blonde. She was dressed pretty scandalously. We became friends, and she turned out to be a pimp. And she offered me to come work for her. And I was 21. And she said, you know, if you come work for me, you know, you can get your life together, whatever, whatever. And my thoughts were, if I did this, I could escape.
For a short period of time, it would be my jump.
Right. I could escape what's going on. I could save money. I could do whatever. So I did this job. And I told Chris, actually. I told him what this job was. And he was okay with it, because it turned out to be his father's ex-girlfriend, this pimp.
He knew all about it.
Yeah. So that's what led me into the game. And it's not, you know, what people think it is. It's not like empowering and you're going to choose your own hours and you get to choose these hot guys. It doesn't work like that. You know, you got to see whoever walks through that door. You've got to give money to your pimp. They're going to do what they want to do to you. And if you don't, they're going to get violent. You know, and I spent 15 years prostituting myself and meeting up with different pimps along the way. And, you know, again, I think the trauma that happened to me before really is what set me up for this. You know, I was so vulnerable. Sex work, let's use this loosely, because it's not sex work.
Yeah, but it's not.
No, it's absolutely not. I just, you know, I didn't have an education. I didn't have positive supports around me. I was stuck in abusive relationships. Somebody had been murdered. Like, it was just crazy. And, you know, that really pushed me to become a really horrible, horrible human being. You know, I desensitized. I became bitter. I was hard. I hated people. My drug addiction spiraled out of control. I was suicidal. And I'm trying to raise kids. And all, you know, my kids witnessed drunken stone mummy. My kids witnessed guys coming in and out of my house over, you know, the period of time. So I don't want to move forward until I do. I will tell you that 3 years after Chris had murdered my husband, I did end up going to the police. It got to a point where the violence was so bad, and he could have killed me at that point. It would have been a blessing. So, you know, here I am with all this guilt because I know what's happened. You know, my husband, mother, and his sister, and everybody is, you know, there. Where's my brother? Where's my son? And I couldn't hold that in anymore. I held it in out of fear. I was scared if I told, I would be killed. So I did turn him in. But it just led me into, you know, bigger addictions. And now I had all this stuff going on in my head mentally. You know, I seen a dead body. You know, I watched him bury my husband. All the abuse, just everything kept taking its toll on me and just building and building and building and building. So I just felt stuck. I didn't feel that I was good enough for anything else. I felt this was what I kind of deserved. I had a lot of shame and a lot of guilt. You know, for years, I blamed myself for what happened to my husband. You know, yes, my husband was a very abusive man. No, he did not deserve to die. But I somewhere inside my head blamed myself, you know, and then I didn't come forward. And it was just a slew of mess. So I ended up just, you know, I was working for, you know, pimps. I was in massage parlors. I was in strip joints. I was working out of hotels. I was working out of my car. I just got to a place where wherever I could make money, I was doing it. Yeah, I didn't care anymore. I didn't care about me. I didn't care about nothing. And then I ended up meeting another pimp. And, you know, he promised me the life. You know, we're going to have a great life. You're going to love me. I'm going to love you.
The Romeo pimp.
Yes, yes. And, you know, I had been in the game at that point for probably 10 years. So you think I would know better. But I was so desperate to be loved. And these guys are master manipulators.
They are amazing with words. They are manipulators. They have studied you for a while before. They know their game. They know what to say in one, in what a specific second they have to.
Yeah, I mean, it's just smooth. I had so much fun with this guy. He was buying me all kinds of stuff. You know, I felt wanted and beautiful. And, you know, he accepted what I did. And it was great. And we could, you know, have a future together. And I ended up having two babies with him. And, you know, I thought, this is great. We're going to have our little family. And I became that bottom bitch. I became the girl who was taking care of the other girls and doing all that kind of stuff because I was pregnant, right? And let's be honest, in the hierarchy of pimping and prostitution, every girl is trying to become that bottom bitch because then you don't have to work. You don't have to exploit yourself. You're on a, you know, you've come up higher on your status.
Which actually make us see very clear that no woman likes or wants to be prostitute.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. You know, I fight with people all the time because they're like, oh, it's your choice. It's empowering. It's this, it's that. It's lack of choice. It's situations that leave a woman vulnerable to believe that this is even an option. You know, nobody wakes up one day, if you come from a good family, you have a great life, and you're going to wake up and go, hey, I want to sleep with 12 guys a day. It just does not happen. Right. So I hear the pros all the time. They're always fighting with me. And I'm like, your voice is 2%, 3%. And let me ask you about your past, because they all have a past. They all say, no, I'm doing this because I want to do this. No, let's look at what led you to even believe.
Exactly.
Yes.
How do you started contemplating the idea?
Absolutely.
Why? How? Absolutely. There's always a reason.
There and there is. I mean, you're not going to see a woman who's got her shit together who's going to be like, yes, this is what I want to do. But we now have this Romeo pimp who is so smooth, who knows the girls to go after, even if they're not vulnerable girls. You know, like we work with girls now, and there's one girl I remember, you know, she went through college, she was in university, and she got lured in by a Romeo pimp, and she came from a good family. But they're so smooth, and they just make you believe that you're loved and you're wanted, and, you know, and then it just spirals out of control. So it can happen to anybody. You know, it's not just the vulnerable girls. It's happening to all of our girls, right? So for me, it took me 15 years to get out. And, you know, I remember the day that I left. My daughter, my firstborn daughter, had become a Christian very, very young. And it was funny because I'd go to work, I'd come home, I'd be high, I'd be drunk, but she'd always pray for me. And she'd always pull scriptures on my door. And, you know, it was just insane, this girl. So she was the first person I called, and I said, I'm done. I'm out. I'm leaving. I can't do this anymore. I got to a point where I was going to hurt somebody or hurt myself. You know, I had become that demon. You know, it was like, you can put, you know, a lion in a cage for so long and pick at it, finally it's going to explode. And that's who I had become. You know, there was no more customers hitting me and forcing me to do things. It was me hitting customers now. It was me just becoming violent. I was becoming them. So I knew I had to get out. And when I got out, it was actually a client who took me out. And this client offered to take care of me and my kids. And, you know, we had become romantically involved. And he did. He took care of me and my kids for 3 years, but I wasn't allowed to work. He controlled all the money. I kind of became his private prostitute, but I thought it was better than what I was doing. So I got out and I just wanted to advocate and start telling people the reality of what happened to women. And so 3 years after being with this man, he decided to leave me one day. And when he left, I had no money. I had no job. I had nowhere to live. So my daughter's youth group leaders in her church offered to help me. And at first I said no, because I was going back to prostitution. Now you have to understand, 3 years I had been out, I had already been working with police, I'd been on front lines, and here I was back in this dilemma going, what the hell am I going to do? And I called my daughter crying and saying, I got to go back.
How old was your daughter back then? I'm sorry.
Oh my gosh, how old was she by then?
Because what she was doing is amazing.
Yeah, she prayed for 10 years for me, this girl. she prayed. So she would have been in her late 20s. No, maybe early 20s. Not even. Still kind of a teenager, I think. I'm no good with the time frames here. But this is 11 years ago. And she's 33. So, yeah, she was in her 20s. And she called me and she's like, Mom, I have these people from the church and they want to help you. And I was like, hell no. No church people. I don't trust them. They're going to judge me, blah, blah, blah. So I made an appointment with a client. And I remember going down to the hotel room and sitting on the bed and thinking, oh my God, if I do this, what if somebody finds out? All the girls that I've helped, if I do this, I'm not going to come back. I knew I probably would have killed myself at that point. So I took the money. And in taking the money, these people became my mentors and they became my spiritual parents. And we just started off and running. And that's how Rising Angels was born. And, you know, we just wanted to give back. I wanted a survivor-led organization. I wanted to tell people the truth. And my mentors helped me get everything together. They helped me financially. They're part of my board of directors. And this is what we've been doing. We actually have a church for women now as well. And so that's kind of who I am and where I'm at and how I got to where I am.
Katerina, what would you say to a person who is living the same experience you did before? A person who has a male saying to her or to him, I love you, please do this for me. If you love me, you will do this, so without even saying why. What would you tell them? What is your advice?
You know what? It really comes down to loving yourself. And that is the hardest thing to do when you've been made to feel unlovable your whole entire life. And we all want to feel loved and we all want to feel important. And unfortunately, a lot of us women put our worth in a man. Like, we're only worth something if we're loved. We're only worth something if somebody wants us. For the women who are out there who are stuck in violent situations, it's not going to change. It's going to get worse. And if he says he's sorry, if he says he's going to get help, walk away and let him prove that to you. Just walk away. Get yourself together. Call somebody for help. For the girls who think, you know, or who are with these boyfriends who are saying, hey, we can have this, we can have that if you'll just do this. He's a master manipulator. He's done this to other women. You're not the only woman. Don't think by far that you are his girlfriend. He's running other girls. And it's a lie. And if you think that you're going to get in there for a few months and you're just going to make money and you're going to get out, that's not going to happen. It's going to change who you are. You know, who I was is gone. She's gone. She's never coming back. And I always tell the young girls, I'm like, you have the opportunity to do anything that you want in the world right now. You can do whatever you want. You have to make a good decision. Otherwise, you're going to try to be digging yourself out of this pit for the rest of your life. Because what it leaves you with is PTSD, is disassociation, is, you know, anxiety and depression and triggers and trauma. Those are things that these women, including myself and yourself, have to live with for the rest of our lives. And love yourself. That's the biggest thing that I can tell a woman, is learn to love yourself. Be comfortable in your own skin. Be independent in yourself. Know what healthy relationships are. Healthy relationships, you know, there's different stages of intimacy. It's not just sex. There's so many more things. You know, it's emotional intimacy and spiritual intimacy, intellectual, social. You need all of those things to have a good relationship, and you need those things for your own self. So love yourself is what I would tell them. You know, run as fast as you can away from these guys. Ask for help. You know what? I held on to abusive relationships. First of all, I didn't want to be like, oh, I told you so, or here it goes again. So I didn't want people to know like what was happening behind closed doors. I want it to be I wanted, you know, as little girls, we're fed this bullshit story of Cinderella and, you know, Sleeping Beauty and, oh, you're going to find your knight in shining armor. And this is what you grow up believing and wanting. And I tell everybody, my whole journey from the beginning to the end was about love, looking for love, just wanting to be loved, wanting to be accepted. Somebody's going to get it. Somebody's not going to hit me as hard. You know, if they weren't physically abusing me, and it was mental, emotional, or sexual abuse, I didn't equate that with abuse because they weren't physical with me. So, you know, I held on so many times for so many different reasons, and it all really came down to me not loving myself, me not believing that I was worth more than that beating, or worth more than that trick, or worth more than that pimp. And I'm not saying I'm all great today. I'm not. I suffer, you know, PTSD and nightmares, and I get overwhelmed, and I still make bad choices. But I'm getting out faster, and I'm learning quicker than I was before. And that's what it comes down to, you know. But I can remember when my parents divorced too. I was so happy. My mother told me that they were divorced, like they were leaving, and I was happy. You know, everybody else was crying, and I was like, good, good.
I was celebrating. Yeah. That was the day of my life.
Yeah. Because, you know, a lot of times as parents, we do stay in these situations. You know, I stayed with my husband because I had a daughter with him and I wanted to have that life that we were all told about. You're going to get married and fall in love and blah, blah, blah. And I stayed and he was abusing me and he was abusing my daughter. But it was OK because he loved us. You know, every day it was I was sorry. Every day I'm going to change. Every day it was he'd hit you and buy you something. And you hold on to that person that you first, you know, met. The wolf in sheep's clothing, right? You know, he sets the precedence and you believe it and you hold on to that going, he's going to go back there. He's going to change back to that person. And then the fact was that he's not, he never will, you know? I believe that people can change and I believe that everybody deserves second chances, but I'm also at a point in my life where you need to prove yourself to me now. You need to prove it. Absolutely. You know, anybody can have good intentions, but let's see people follow through, right? So I spent my whole entire, you know, life being beaten by men and abused by men and exploited by men. And, you know, you would think I hate men. And, you know, I just want women out there to know that you're not alone. You are not alone. You know, that, you know, if you need help, reach out. You know, if you feel you can't talk to somebody, phone me, get a hold of me, you know, go to my website, do whatever you need to do because you're not alone and you don't have to go through this alone. And nobody expects you just to get out of it and you're going to be better. It's a long haul. It's a lot of work, but it can be done. It absolutely can be done.
Definitely an incredible story, Katarina. You grew up dealing with a lot of abuse, definitely, and we can tell that it was escalating very rapidly, and unfortunately, every time that you try to get a new relationship, another type of abuse show up. Very sad, but very happy that you are out of that with a better life, definitely. And tell us about your kids. How are they nowadays? How are they growing? What do they like to do? How are they? Tell us a little about them, please. Let's talk about something happier.
I have an amazing relationship with all of my children. My daughter, my firstborn daughter, she's a Christian. She does missions work. She's, you know, going all over the world. And three of my kids actually are living with me right now. They're good kids. You know, I have two boys and two girls. My boys are stand-up men. They're stand-up men. They are the men who will come with me on marches and come to my speaking gigs and support what I do. Their father was my pimp, right?
Yeah. So they do know firsthand how everything is, you know?
Absolutely. I am very open with my children. We have an amazing relationship. They support what I do. We've done the work, you know. When my kids would come to me and say, you know, Mom, you messed me up. You brought in abusive men. I watched this. I watched that. you know, I never made an excuse. I never said, well, I was messed up and well, people hurt me. It was like, you know what? I took accountability and I said, you're right. And I'm sorry. And I can't change what I did, but I can only try to do what I can do now. So we have a really good relationship. You know, they're good kids. They're good kids. You know, restoration happens. You know, for me, it's a God thing. It's absolutely a God thing. And I have people in my life now who are good people, who are supportive people, who love me. I have, you know, a friend list that I'm just like, oh my gosh, you know, I never had positive people in my life. And now I do. And it's just, it's an amazing feeling.
Great. Yeah. And that's amazing. And once you get out, well, I think everybody should have like a group of healthy friends. Everybody.
Absolutely. Yes.
But especially people like us, yes, that have been through this trauma, we need to do this. And something that I have found, I'm pretty sure you have found along the way as well with helping other survivors and in your personal life, is I never knew what boundaries were.
No.
At all.
No,
I have no idea. My father was abusive. There was no space in it. He asked me something. I had it to answer. If the answer was not please, probably a snap or something. Yep. So there's no sense of bending. So I found that now teaching about boundaries is like a must do.
Yes.
For the other survivors, you know, not only for everybody, because I think that should be like a school topic.
Yeah.
Maybe around, you know, elementary. It should be elementary.
Yes.
I don't know why we are not working into, you know, life skills nowadays.
Oh.
Very important. And now with COVID, we're finding other people don't even know how to cook rice, you know?
it's insane. It's true. And I think the sad thing is that, you know, even when we go in to try to educate these kids, you know, they're only letting us go into high schools, and we need to get to these kids before high school. We need to get to them in elementary school, like you said, you know, because everybody's like, oh no, we don't want them to hear about it. We want to protect them. The average age of a child watching pornography is 9 years old. So our kids know more than we want to give them credit for. They're being exposed to more than we think. These parents who think that it's not going to happen to their kids or they're so guarded, they're kidding themselves. These kids are up chatting other kids. They're learning lingo that we never learned at certain ages. They're exposed to so many things just by social media alone. You know, so I think, you know, it is teaching your kids boundaries. It is teaching your kids it's okay to say no. It is, you know, putting those boundaries in place for your safety. And unfortunately, the society we live in now, our kids don't know how to communicate. You know, it's all via computer. It's all, you know, that's my best friend. I met them on Facebook 2 weeks ago, but we've never met in person, right? So
yeah,
our kids have lost out. And these guys are predators, and they're getting people off Facebook. They're getting kids off Instagram, off gaming sites. This is what they do. And
yeah, because kids are just playing, and sometimes it's just innocent things they are doing.
Yeah.
They are just playing Minecraft. What is bad about Minecraft? Well, we have one case in the United States where this child was in Minecraft and he got a friendship request for communication. I'm not into games, but you know, that's my understanding. And after 2-3 days, this person said, like, hey, would you like to meet up in real life in the real park?
Yeah.
This set up. She went there and she got trafficked. She
yes.
was rescued after 12 days, but she got trafficked.
Yes.
On Minecraft.
Yes.
And so one tip that I always said to, you know, parents is just cut down the chat.
Yep.
They can definitely play with people and everything. They don't need to chat with them because we don't have that time. We're not with them 24/7. So while we're working, while we are doing our stuff, while we're cooking, while we're all just resting, taking a shower, they can actually be like just playing and having this communication with some predator or a future trafficker, and we are not aware. So if we could have communication chat, I think that's a good start.
Yes. I think it's so important. You know, like my son, he does Minecraft. He does a lot of gaming. And I was always, you know, you're not going to get your passwords from your kids. You know, once they hit a certain age, they're like, forget it. You're not getting into my business. But if you educate them early enough on what to look for and what's wrong, they will come to you. And I remember my son coming to me when he was doing this gaming, and he said, Mom, I've got this friend request from this man who's asking for my pictures, who's, you know, being very right away. And I said, whoa. And I got online with this guy and I'm like, ah, you know, freaking out. But it's happening. And if you can educate your kids where they feel comfortable enough to come to you and say, hey, this is happening, it's going to make a world of difference.
And how do we do that? How do we gain our kids' trust so they can know that no matter what happened, we're not just going to pretty much kill them?
You know, well, you know what? How do we come to me first?
Right. I think it has to start young. It really has to start young, and that communication has to be open. Like, my kids can talk to me about anything, whether it be, you know, drugs or sex or, you know, what's going on in the world. They can talk to me, because parents have to understand your kids are going to do things, whether it be experiment with drugs, whether it be going drinking with their friends, whether it be having sex. They're going to do these things at some point in their life. And if you make them feel comfortable enough to be able to talk to you about it, you have a chance to stop what could end up in a very bad situation. You know, my children will come and talk to me about everything they've done, tried, or are thinking of trying in their lives, because I've opened that door for them. And we have a talk. And when they come to me and they say something to me that I don't like, I'm not on them going, well, I told you not to do this or don't do that. We talk about it. Well, why? Why are you doing this? What's going on? You know, what's led you here? It's having that communication. Stop being so hard on your kids of just shutting them down and not letting them talk. You know, you want to be the parent, that's great, but it's not like, oh, you're going to go to your room and you're going to get a spanking and you're going to no, talk to your kids. Find out what is happening. Why did your kids pick up a joint and smoke them? Why are they talking to somebody online? You know, why? These are the questions that we need to ask. Yes.
With Rising Angels, your days must be so busy and different. I can only imagine. Tell us, how is one of your days, please?
I mean, every day is different. So, you know, people will hire me to do speaking. So whether I'm sharing my story, I'm education, I'm training front lines, it just depends on where I'm going and who I'm speaking to. But there's meetings, you know, I sit at different round tables. My phone's 24/7. So we have girls who are calling my phone 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's available for them. So they'll call me and I mentor them. You know, girls who I've, you know, been walking alongside of for years, and some of them are new and they just don't know where to go or what to do or how to get through the emotions. And so I talk them down and we try to put things into perspective for them and, you know, logically, and let's talk about this, because a lot of times when a girl comes from this, the trauma is deep and they're going to have nightmares and they're going to have fears. And sometimes they even want to go back, because it was easier to be there than it is easier to do this life. Because what does this life even look like? This is not normal. You know, the other way was normal, right? So talking them through them, helping them get through that. We have a trauma-informed counselor that if they want that specific counseling, they can do. And I'm kind of like their, you know, they call me Mama Cat. You know, I walk alongside of them and I just help them and I'm here for them. We also help the moms in the families whose children have gone through this. So how do they get through this? How do they understand what their daughter's coming home like, because she's going to be different? So we help them, you know, we help the parents, and we just, our biggest thing is getting these girls from A to B, because if you can start that process and you can gain that trust with them, and in gaining that trust, you have to be consistent. You know, you have to be consistent with these girls. A lot of people will be like, oh, we'll send her here, we'll send her there, we'll send her here. You can't do that. That's re-victimization. She needs to find one person that she trusts and that she can talk to. She doesn't need to talk to a bunch of people and keep reliving her story. You know, there's most of the times when I mentor girls, I don't even ask their story. Okay, we deal with what's going on right then and there. I don't need to know all the details. unless they choose to share that with me. But I don't sit here and say, well, what happened to you? What's going on? I let them talk about what's going on right at that second. We try to stabilize them in their anxiety. Once I've worked with them that way for a while, then we're going to go back and we're going to figure out where was the initial trauma that even led you vulnerable to this to begin with, so that you don't repeat this somewhere in your life. And not by falling back into, you know, being trafficked or sexually exploited, but maybe just in everyday life, in relationships and people you deal with. Let's get to the root cause of what led you vulnerable to begin with. So that's kind of what we do.
Any male survivors?
I've had phone calls from males, but we don't specifically deal with men. You know, there isn't a lot of support for men out there. And I have had boys, younger boys call me, and men who do call me and say, you know, I'm trapped, I've been trafficked, whatever, whatever. And I usually will get them in touch with somebody who I know can help them, which is a man. Who he does a lot of the work that I do. So I will get them in touch with them. I don't just leave them hanging. And, you know, another thing when we do education, because we talk about this education, how important it is for the girls and the girls. Well, it's important for the boys too. It's very important for the boys because there are a lot of boys that not only are being, you know, exposed to this by their peers and their friend groups, but, you know, pimping has become almost cool. You know, the whole pimping culture is cool. And to have a slew of women is cool. You know, my son come home from school one day and he said, Mom, you know, now we have a main girlfriend and a side girlfriend. That's pimp lingo. Pimp lingo is you have a main bitch and a side bitch. That's pimp lingo. And it's being glorified. So we need to educate the boys on what's happening, because boys are not only being recruited for sex trafficking, but being recruited to become pimps. Right? So I think it's very important that we remember that when we're going into schools and when we're speaking. It's not just about the girls. The boys are vulnerable too.
What is the one thing that we need the most when helping survivors? What do you think it is?
Housing. I mean, housing for these women is the number one gap there is. But it's not just, you know, there's different organizations out there who have houses for women, but they're you have to follow this protocol, or you have to have certain things to get into this house. You know, you have to be sober for this long, or you can't be on the methadone program, or you have to go to church, or whatever the heck it is. There's always some stipulation for a girl to be able to go into a house and get help. My dream is to have an apartment building. I don't want a house. I want 40 rooms. I want to take the girls right from the dirty. I want the girls who are the addicts. I want the girls that nobody would help, who are struggling. I want to be able to take them right into our place and detox them and help them and get them all that kind of therapy, and not say, oh, you can't come here until you're in a detox for 30 days. Or you can't. If a girl wants out and you don't got anywhere to put her right at that moment, you are going to lose her.
Yeah.
You know? So for me, the biggest gap is putting these girls in places that are really actually helping them to get through this trauma. And they're not just a number. They're not just for the government numbers of, look, we've housed these many girls and now we need more funding. But people who actually know what the hell they're doing to get these girls to where they need to go. So that's the biggest thing that I see. Secondly, I think because we separate, what's happening is we separate human trafficking and prostitution. So there's funding for human trafficking, but there's nothing for people who are stuck in prostitution. And they need to understand, I don't separate them. To me, human trafficking and prostitution are one and the same thing. It's done differently, but it's still the lack of choice that leaves you there. It's emotional chains, whatever the hell it is, you're still stuck there. So there's no help for these women who are prostituting themselves. They're looked at as disposable, or it's a choice, or they're just drug addicts, or they're lazy. And that's really been my heart, is to bring awareness around those girls, because I was that girl. I was in the game and I was an independent worker for a very long time. But why? Why was I? What led me there? And this is what I want people to understand, that, you know, prostitution and trafficking go hand in hand. You know, I know so many girls who went into this game thinking they were just going to be independent and ended up being trafficked, you know? So I think we've got to stop separating the two. you know, to be able to realize that this, they're all somebody's daughters. You know, they're all there because of some kind of trauma. Something happened that led them vulnerable to even think that this is a choice. You know, it's lack of choice. So that would be what I'd like to see happen, more advocacy around that. They're pro groups. They're very much like, oh, well, prostitution's a choice, but human trafficking isn't. And I fight with people constantly. This has been my fight. And I refuse to work with a lot of people now. I refuse to sit on panels. I refuse to hear their bullshit. I just refuse. And a lot of people, they like me, but they don't like me because I'm going to tell it how it is. And I don't care. I don't care. I'm not going to sit around a round table where they go, well, we're going to help a woman who's been, you know, human trafficked, but the girls who are prostituting, that's their choice. That's their bodies. Are you kidding me? You know, so that is a huge thing for me. That's where my advocacy comes from. That's where my heart is wanting to help those women that they think deserve or choose to be there. That's what I want.
And I applaud that, and I am so grateful for your voice, Katarina.
Oh, I'm grateful for yours. I mean, you have a story, and you know, I see the life in your eyes, and I love that. I love that. I love that you have that voice, that you're out there doing it, because we need people like you. We need people who actually get it. You know, not people who are just falling on this bandwagon because it's the flavor of the month and everybody's talking about trafficking and we can get funding, but they don't know what the heck they're talking about or doing. So, you know, I applaud you for what you're doing.
Oh my God, I love this conversation. It's been amazing. I enjoy it. This time has been flying. Thank you so much for being with us, for bringing awareness about human trafficking, about sexual assault, about all these type of issues that are linked to each other. Katarina, you are so brave. You are amazing. Your work is amazing and you are helping people. You are making a difference, and I'm very, very glad to meet you and to have you here at Cindy's Voice podcast as a guest. It's been my privilege. Thank you for being here.
Definitely. Yeah, thank you so much.
And that's all for today's episode of Cindy's Voice. Thanks for listening, and thank you, Katarina, for joining us today and for sharing your amazing story. I'm sure we all have learned something positive that we can use to help someone else or even ourselves. Join us next week. We're going to have our special guest, Ana Cardona, who will stop by to talk a little bit about re-exploitation. How can this possibly happen? How can we don't learn from the first time? How do we don't see the patterns? Well, she will be joining us to answer all of these questions and to give us a clue on this topic. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on Spotify, iTunes, Anchor, Stitcher, or any platform that you prefer, so you never miss an episode. Thanks for listening to Cindy's Voice podcast. Have a great week.
Thanks for joining us this week on Cindy's Voice. If you like what you're listening to, like our YouTube channel, Cindy's Voice Podcast, and give us a 5-star review. This means everything to us. Follow us on Instagram at Cindy V. Rivero to receive updates on our latest episode. See you in our next episode. Till then, have a great week.